Hi there, this is the podcast designed to lift you up, cool you down in this autumnal heatwave, and make you feel better about life in the world of primary care with some free CPD thrown in too. We've got some primary care pearls of wisdom to share with you to make your life easier. Coming up, we're talking about bites, human, animal, and insect. We look at all things bite related, including assessment, management, and who needs antibiotics. De Quervain's tenosynovitis, what is it and why we shouldn't suggest it might have an occupational cause. Some tips on doing the 6 to 8 week baby check as a welcome to our new GPSTs, and also for those of us who learnt this longer ago than we would like to admit, have we thought about what might have changed? And assertiveness. Often we say yes to things to help our patients and colleagues, but sometimes we need to say no. And if we do need to say no, how good are we at being assertive? And to hear a cautionary tale from a listener about how, despite the best intentions, a nail issue didn't turn out to be as straightforward as first thought. But I can't do all this by myself. Who's going to keep me company?
Hi, I'm Caroline Green.
And I'm Nick Kendrew.
We're both part of the Red Whale presenting team.
Come with us to reignite your passion for primary care.
Welcome to the August Primary Care Pod from Red Whale.
The Primary Care Pod from Red Whale.
Hi Caroline, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Nick. I'm sort of starting to get that back to school feeling, wanting to get back to a bit of routine after the sort of school holiday shuffle. How about you?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's that autumnal feeling, isn't it? And it's lovely when it gets a little bit less, although I was going to say a little bit less hot, though. I think you blink and you missed our summer this year. but I do like that autumnal feeling, and I like it when the leaves are starting to turn and all that kind of stuff. It's a lovely time of year.
It really is. And I'm thinking very warmly of all our lovely colleagues who haven't taken annual leave over the summer halls and still have theirs to look forward to as we go into the autumn. So if that's one of you, we hope you have a brilliant time when you get there.
Yeah, and because a lot of people, I'm sure, will be hanging on because the summer has been a bit busier than usual, hasn't it? It's been quite full on.
Yeah, I think the slightly less than optimal weather has probably meant that we've perhaps been a bit busier, and those triage lists haven't really quietened down very much.
No, sadly not. And talking about busy, we've got lots of things to pack into the podcast this month.
A crazy one, isn't it? It's so busy this month.
It is. So shall we get cracking and get talking?
Let's
about
crack
the first
on.
One?
Yeah.
Brilliant. So let's look at our first pearl. And this is what we said when we released it. Time outdoors, watch out for those bites. It's that time of year, school holidays, walking in the countryside, sandy sandwiches on a spiky sand dune. And the triage list is full of bite, query, infected. In this week's pearl, we look at all things bite related, from humans to mammals, insects to snakes. Well, there seemed to be something for everybody. So that was that pearl. And it took me about 10 minutes, 42 seconds to read the entirety of that.
Yeah, it's quite a long read, isn't it? You wouldn't believe there was so much to bite. Mm. But actually, this was the one this month that made me think. Because, you know, there is quite a lot to consider. And it's surprisingly interesting stuff. So we're going to spend a bit of time on this one. And it might be of value to any of the ARRS roles you have in practice or nurse colleagues who've been providing support manning those summer triage lists. So please do feel free to share the written pearl and the podcast with them if they aren't joining us already. We want these free Redwell resources to be for everyone.
Absolutely. So Caroline, have you got some headlines for us?
Yes, I do. So here we go. So insect bites, probably the most common requests we'll get of the bites family. And most don't need antibiotics. Rapid onset skin reaction, much more likely to be inflammatory than infective. Our second headline: for human and animal bites, we should think the five S's: severity, site, species, sign of infection, and significant comorbidities, because they'll help you decide what to do. Infected bites will need antibiotics and can usually be managed like cellulitis. And some bites also need prophylactic antibiotics, and we'll be pointing out a handy table in the article to help you decide. And lastly, might not come as a surprise, we should discuss unusual bites, exotic animals, bird, farm animals, with microbiology before prescribing.
You're saying about insect bites being the most common. So shall we tackle those first?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, because I think actually one of the most common misconceptions that we have to dispel is the belief that because an insect bite looks red and swollen, it must be infected and antibiotics are needed. And I don't know about you, Nick, but I think historically we've probably prescribed too many antibiotics in this situation, because for insect bites, we should only be prescribing antibiotics if there are signs of infection.
Yeah, it's actually really good to see that in black and white, because sometimes it's difficult to get that across, because people sometimes will come with the expectation that this is infected in their eyes and therefore they want antibiotics. So sometimes it's good to go through what the signs of infection are with them to say why perhaps they don't need antibiotics. So how do we separate out the ones that we need to worry about and treat and the ones that we could encourage people to self-manage?
Yeah, absolutely. So the article offers us a few pointers that we should be aware of. So the first thing is that a rapid reaction to a typical insect bite, so within minutes to hours, is much more likely to be inflammatory or allergic. And that can be self-managed with things like cold compresses and antihistamines. And going back to what you said about patient expectation, I think, you know, we have to remember these can look pretty impressive. They can be big, red, swollen, they can be pretty sore. So that good explanation is really important. And if we're going to encourage patients to self-manage with those things, then obviously we need a safety net and explain when we would expect the skin reaction to settle down. And actually what the NICE guidance tells us is that's within 10 days. So it's a reasonably long period of time, but it should be gradually improving. And that we wouldn't expect the bite to cause any systemic features of infection, so no fever or aches, chills, that kind of thing. What we also should be saying is that if there's increasing redness, pain and tenderness that carries on over days, then that might be a sign of cellulitis. And if those things are present or the systemic features, we need to see those people in primary care and think, is it infected? And if it is, then NICE suggests we should actually be managing that like cellulitis. So typically, Flu-Clox first line or clarithromycin if they're allergic, but a different choice of antibiotics for the face, coamoxiclav, or a combination of clarithro and metronidazole if they're allergic. And all of this is in the article if you need to red whale it later.
Excellent. Now, obviously, if there were suggestions of anaphylaxis, then we need to refer that patient. But in this scenario, anaphylaxis hopefully hasn't made it onto our triage list. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, exactly. But we should seek advice if the bite was caused by an unusual or exotic insect, or the person is high risk because of conditions such as immunosuppression, diabetes or lymphedema, or if the bite occurred outside the UK and the person has skin changes or a fever. And that made me think, Caroline, what about Lyme disease?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Nick. And we haven't forgotten that, but it's actually a really big topic in its own right. And if we'd put that in this article as well, it would have taken forever to read. So there's a whole separate article on Lyme disease in Redwell Knowledge. But what we should think about is if the person's been in an area where there are ticks, and particularly if they have an erythema migrans rash, and if you're not sure what that is, there's a link to it in the Lyme disease article. Maybe we'll put one in the show notes, Nick. But then we need to be thinking about Lyme, and there's a whole process we should follow. What we shouldn't be doing is giving prophylactic antibiotics to people with a history of a tick bite, but with no rash and no symptoms.
Okay, thank you. On to human and animal bites now, and how to use the five S's to document the wound and guide management. Now, this came from NICE guidance, which was published in 2020. But before the five S's comes first aid. Now, most of us are very lucky to have amazing practice nurses and paramedics in our primary care teams who will do this initial first aid for us. So if you're one of those team members and you're going to be doing that, well, hi to you and welcome to the Redwell Pod. And thank you as
Hello.
Well. And for any of us providing this first aid, then just to run through it, we should irrigate and clean the wound and check for signs of infection. And remember that puncture wounds shouldn't be closed. We also need to be aware of the complex wound. So any wound which involves bone, joint, tendon or vascular structures, they need secondary care review. So in your role, can you refer yourself or do you need to involve another clinician to help with that? Also think safeguarding. Do we need to be a bit more curious about how the bite happened? Remember, safeguarding is all of our responsibility, and if you have concerns, then it's your duty to act on them. And if you aren't sure, then you can discuss it with the team or, if necessary, with the local safeguarding leads. Also, think, are vaccinations needed? Luckily, we've got a handy tetanus article to help you decide when to consider this. And we also need to think about rabies vaccination in bat bites. And for domestic animals, we should ask if... I know, yes, we should, though. And for domestic animal bites, we should also ask if the rabies immunisation status of the animal is known. I think we can assume that bats haven't been vaccinated. Now, for human bites that have broken the skin, we also need to consider blood-borne virus risk, and we might need to phone a friend in the microbiology department for advice on that. So, having done all of that, we now need to decide whether antibiotics and referral are needed.
Wow, it's amazing. There's so much to think about with bites, isn't there? Right.
Absolutely.
Well, this is where the five S's come in. And we can use this to guide and document the wound and to determine the management, because we're deciding two key things here. Is this wound infected, or is it at high risk of infection, indicating that actually we need to prescribe antibiotics to prevent infection? So let's just go through that a little bit. And you'll see there's a table in the article in the show notes that guides you through this. So the first S is S for severity. Is the skin broken? Was blood drawn? How deep is the wound? And as Nick said earlier, if the wound does involve bone, joint, tendon or vascular structures, it needs secondary care review. And it's particularly wounds on the hands and digits that we need to be careful of. So just be aware of that. The second S is site. So it's important to establish, is this bite in a high risk area?
And where might that be, Caroline?
Yeah, so the face, the hands, the feet, the genitals, skin overlying cartilaginous structure, anywhere with poor local circulation. And again, this is relevant to decide, does this person need prophylactic antibiotics? So it's important for us to know.
And what about our third S?
Well, this is the exciting bit. This is species. And there are kind of five categories that NICE look at that help us decide. So human bites, cat bites, other common pet bites, so dogs, hamsters, rabbits, exotic animals, including birds and presumably bats as well, based on what we've said, and farm animals, which depending where you work may or may not be an issue. Then our fourth S is signs of infection. So looking out for systemic features. And finally, our final S, significant comorbidity. So anything really that puts the person at increased risk of serious skin infections. And these are the usual culprits. So things like diabetes, immunosuppression, that kind of thing.
Excellent. So there's a lot to go through there, isn't there? And in case you were wondering, the reason that we need to seek specialist advice about those more exotic animals is because they're caused by different bacteria, which may need to have different antibiotics prescribed for them.
If we're managing these patients in primary care, we need to remember again safety netting, and it's one of our primary care superpowers. It should be specific, and we should advise the person to be reassessed if signs of infection worsen rapidly, if the infection doesn't start to improve within 24, 48 hours of starting treatment, or if they become systemically unwell, or if they develop severe pain that's out of proportion to what they can see on the surface. So that's sort of if we suspect the bite's infected. But what about uninfected bites, those people we see quite early on in the course? Who needs antibiotic prophylaxis, Nick?
Well, that depends on the species and whether the skin was broken and whether blood was drawn. Now, we can't possibly remember all of this, but there's a great table in the Pearl. But one simple thing that we probably can remember is that for human and most typical domestic pets, if the skin is not broken, then antibiotics aren't needed. Now, for the rest, red whale it. It's in the Pearl, and it's also on Red Whale Knowledge as well. Or you could also use your preferred clinical support tool.
Brilliant. So shall we have a look at what our learning points are for insect and animal bites?
Yes. So here are those learning points. And for insect bites, a rapid onset of skin reaction is more likely to be inflammation than infection. And you treat infected bites according to NICE guidance on cellulitis.
When assessing a human or animal bite, consider those five S's: severity, site, species, signs of infection and significant comorbidities.
Bites that are high risk on these criteria may require antibiotics, even if there are no signs of infection.
And any bite from an exotic animal, bird or farm animal should be discussed with a microbiologist before prescribing. And we'd love to hear on the pod, Nick, wouldn't we, about your most exotic animal bites you've dealt with in practice.
Absolutely. Time for our second pearl now, and we're talking about De Quervain's tenosynovitis, spotting it and managing it. And this one took me 6 minutes, 34 seconds to read the pearl, and the video bite to watch with Mike is 5 minutes and 48 seconds.
Oh, so the bite's more efficient this month, isn't it? So this topic, actually, this is the one I've been waiting for without even realising it, because this article came to me for a second clinical review as part of our system. And I have to say, for my absolute shame, I'd never even heard of this somehow. And so that's why I picked it as a pearl, because I thought there must be at least one other person out there who was in the dark like me.
I learned loads from reading about it as well. So here's how we introduced the pearl when we released it. So it was lots of different quotes. So it says, "I've been out in the garden all summer and my wrist is killing me." Alan, 65. "I've been playing FIFA 23 all summer and my wrist is killing me." Damon, 14. "I just can't pick up the baby anymore. My wrist is killing me." Shanaz, who's 32. "What do all these people have in common? Well, they might have De Quervain's tenosynovitis." Now, I thoroughly recommend both reading the pearl and then cementing your knowledge by watching Mike's brilliant video bite as well. And De Quervain's tenosynovitis is a common primary care presentation, and I love a good old-fashioned clinical diagnosis, and this is one of those. It tends to cause pain and swelling. Yay! It's really nice when it falls into place like that. It tends to cause pain and swelling on the radial aspect of the wrist, and it tends to be more common in our dominant hand because, of course, we use it more. So, Caroline, can you give us a bit more detail on that?
I can do now, though if you'd asked me last month, it would have been a different story. So, in De Quervain's, there's thickening and degeneration of like the shared tendon sheath that contains the tendons of abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis. And the changes can cause narrowing of that canal, which basically squeezes the tendon fibres and makes them swell up so they can't glide smoothly anymore. So it's kind of a mechanical problem. And as you said, Nick, it's related to overuse. So where somebody's doing repeated movements, but bizarrely, we don't really know the underlying pathology. And it's kind of considered to be a fibrotic pathology rather than an inflammatory process. So then my new knowledge about this led me on to think, well, how many of these have I missed? And is it all that common, Nick?
Well, its incidence is about 1 in 1,000 per year. So most of us are likely to see a few cases each year. It's more common in women. And the peak incidence is in our 50s, but pregnant and postnatal females have increased incidence too. So what are the typical scenarios that we might see it in?
Well, I think it's similar to those we captured in the intro to the pearl. So looking for those repeated activities in the history. So postpartum women carrying the baby around, certain breastfeeding positions where we're supporting with the dominant arm. It's also strongly associated with video gaming, and you might have heard it called gamer's thumb. Interestingly, it isn't thought to be occupational, and apparently no study's ever been done that established an association between hand use or trauma at work with De Quervain's. So it's worth us remembering in primary care that actually most of us are not occupational health experts, and so it might be unwise for us to say that, in our professional opinion, that this condition was caused by a patient's job. So writing that on a fit note or a report, because it's actually a potentially really contentious medico-legal situation, and you could be called on to justify your opinion.
Yeah, so don't go there. Our lives are stressful enough without adding to it. We want a nice and calm consultation where the history gives us the clues and our examination confirms our suspicions. If only life was always like that. Now, if you want to make a confident diagnosis, then here's what we're looking for. We're looking for gradual onset of pain, tenderness and swelling on the radial side of the wrist. And that's around 1 to 2 centimetres proximal to the radial styloid. And the pain is exacerbated by thumb movement as well.
And Nick, am I right that if you're feeling super snazzy, you can do a special test?
Absolutely. But we're not going to go through it now, because it's complicated to do without any visuals. So what I'd recommend doing, it's Finkelstein's test that we want to know about. And Mike demonstrates it beautifully in the video bite. So I recommend going to have a look at that. So once we've done all that, what can we actually do about this, Caroline?
Well, I think most importantly, like all sort of tendinopathies, resting from the activity that's causing problem is the key thing. And if that's vigorous gardening or playing video games, that's usually reasonably easy to do. Now, I acknowledge I'm saying this as a mum whose child is not yet a teenager, so, you know, it may not always be that easy for the parents to encourage. But the real challenge is the postpartum cases. Obviously, resting from carrying your baby or from breastfeeding isn't quite so easy. And so we might have to think a bit laterally about things like using slings or adapting breastfeeding holds. And, you know, historically, our health visitors would have been able to help to advise on these issues, but it's often not feasible in lots of areas around the country. So there might be a bit of lateral thinking required about, you know, are there local third sector organisations that could support? Is your social prescribing link worker or health navigators in the practice aware of groups that might be able to help mums access things like a sling library or that kind of thing? Just a bit of something to think about there. Now, just adapting activity might be enough, but to manage the acute situation, if the person's got quite a bit of pain, we can use good old non-steroidals, either topical or oral, providing there are no contraindications. And in some cases, immobilizing the thumb with a thumb splint for 4 to 6 weeks might help. And you might be able to access those through your local MSK hub. It's where sort of our occupational therapists can come in useful if you can access those in that way to help providing those tools. And then the last thing to be aware of is this is actually one of those situations where a corticosteroid injection can actually really make a difference. There's a reasonable evidence base for that. And it can be used in pregnancy and breastfeeding women. There was a meta-analysis done on this actually in 2015, and it showed that a corticosteroid injection provided about an 84% success rate in reducing symptoms significantly compared with any of the other measures, so splinting, placebo injection or acupuncture. So it is worth thinking about. And if you don't know how to do this yourself, could you find out whether anyone else at your practice can, or consider if it's something you might want to learn yourself or as a team? Now, we do say in the article, if all else fails, which is pretty rare, surgical release of the extensor compartment might be performed. But I don't know if any of you out there have ever had to refer for that. Clearly, I haven't, because I've never diagnosed a case before now. So there we go.
I haven't diagnosed many cases, so I'm thinking I must have missed a few too, but I don't think I've ever referred for surgical release either yet. So that's the end of that, Pearl. And here are the learning points for de Quervain's tenosynovitis. It's a relatively common condition, especially in pregnancy or the postpartum period.
We can look for pain over the radial styloid area.
It's a clinical diagnosis. Brilliant.
Yay. Treatment involves rest, non-steroidals and maybe a corticosteroid injection.
And surgical options are available for those not responding to conservative measures. Okay, so now it's time for my second favourite part of the podcast. I'll tell you what my favourite bit is in a minute. It will become clear in a second, but this is still way up there because it puts a smile on our faces. And thank you for sending all of your best intention stories in. So let's crack on with this month's one. Dear Caroline and Nick, I felt I had to share my best intention story so that next time you're having a bad day at work, you can think of this and perhaps things won't they won't seem so bad. In the days before COVID, when everything was face-to-face and we didn't have the variety of appointment types that we have now, I'd always run very late. I had a mental list of dream conditions that would walk in and I'd jump for joy inside because suddenly, for a brief second, I felt I might have a chance to catch up a bit and for a moment, I'd feel like I was winning. Fungal toenail infections were one such condition. Or so I thought. In walked my patient, let's call her Miss Scarlett. She said that she thought she had a fungal toenail infection. I had a look and I agreed with her. I told her that we'd send off some clippings and I'd call her to discuss the results. I did that a few weeks ago, she said. I scrolled down a bit further in the notes and indeed she had been to see a colleague and nail clippings had been sent off. I checked the result. Negative. I shared this with her. And she told me that this kept on happening and she was quite upset by the whole process. She asked me again if I thought it looked like a fungal nail infection. Again, I agreed. And she said, well, if we both think it is, then can't you just give me the treatment? I've tried the nail lacquer before and it doesn't work. Well, we should really prove it with nail clippings, I said. but I take your point. I can see you're frustrated. You'll need a blood test before you start and some regular tests during treatment. If you get those done and they're right, I'll prescribe it. But sometimes people can have reactions to these drugs, and I'd really rather try to get a positive result first, because there are false negative results 30% of the time. I was pleased with that last bit because I looked it up on GPCPD, soon to become Redwell Knowledge. I like that bit too. Now, I know I buckled under pressure, but I had the best intentions because I wanted to help this frustrated patient with what was clinically looking like a fungal nail infection. In my head, there was a little voice saying, "What could possibly go wrong?" Well, I'll tell you exactly what could go wrong, because a few weeks later, after a normal baseline set of blood tests, my patient had started treatment as agreed. She came to see me looking rather sheepish. I didn't recognise her at first because Miss Scarlet had changed colour to match her name. From head to toe, she was covered in an itchy rash. She wasn't just scarlet, she was puce. Thankfully, she had no signs of anaphylaxis and she was fine about the whole thing, so we agreed to stop the offending medication and give treatment to help with the allergic symptoms, and I reassured her that it should all settle down, but to come back if she got worse or was concerned. The next day she came back again, feeling really unwell. Still no anaphylaxis, thankfully, but she was feverish with it now too. I put on my best, "Don't panic, everything's fine" face, and I spoke to the medical reg at the hospital. They were happy to see her, and they admitted her for several days, and her diagnosis on discharge was a severe reaction to the medication I'd prescribed. Now, thankfully, she made a full recovery and was fine with me too, and my learning point from all of this is not to prescribe antifungal medication without a positive nail clipping result, and not to be pushed into a management decision I know deep down isn't what I'd normally do. Oh, my goodness. I think
we've all been there, though, haven't we?
And my goodness.
Oh, poor thing. Yeah.
Yes.
It's so tricky. I thought where the story was going was that she'd been clipping her fingernails rather than her toenails, and that's why we got the false negative result or something like that. But oh, poor thing. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that so we can all learn from it and just give us that little bit of extra sort of oomph to say no when it's difficult.
Exactly. So which bit of that are you going to put on your action plan?
All of it, I think.
See, that's my favourite part of the podcast now, because in my head, I've got a mental image of you with a big Mary Poppins carpet bag with this massive long action plan that you put all these things onto.
Absolutely. Oh, cool. Okay. Cool.
So have you got the Redwell calendar there?
I do, yes. So September is a super busy month for us at Redwell. So as we speak, we're just checking through the proofs for the next GP and nurse and pharmacist update courses. And some of our presenters are out on the road. So we might see you down in Torquay or over in Suffolk or Staffordshire, where we've got a course I'm really looking forward to, actually, where we're getting all the additional roles together and doing a nice update and celebrating the contribution they've been making to primary care in that area. We're filming all of our content for our autumn update courses. And yeah, Mike and Andrew are on the sofa for an MSK together. Busy time. So we look forward to seeing some of you round and about the country or on our digital courses.
Yeah. And if you bump into us, then say hi, because it's always lovely to have people saying hello. So hello to you if you're coming on one of those courses.
Definitely.
Okay. So shall we move on to our next poll?
Our next one came out just as a new cohort of GPSTs and foundation doctors were starting on their primary care journey. And we decided to say hello and to share our article on the 6 to 8 week baby check and maternal postnatal review. And of course, this might be a new skill for many of those trainees moving into primary care, and they need the support of more experienced clinicians to help. And we hoped that this article helped. So if you have any trainees in your practice and they haven't seen it, please feel free to share with them. And Nick, there's so much we could talk about here, but probably the listeners will be pleased to know we aren't going to read out the big long list of things that NICE recommend we should do, but just pick out a few things that surprised us or that we thought were important themes. And the first thing for me was that actually these appointments are some of my favourite in primary care, and many practices have moved to doing them as two separate appointments on separate days. Is that the case in your practice, Nick?
Well, not yet. It is something we've talked about, and we are aiming to do that. And at the moment, we do the maternal and baby checks, and then the baby has their IMS appointment with our practice nurse afterwards. And if I've been doing it, then normally it's a bit late, so I apologise for that. But it certainly makes sense to separate out the maternal check from the baby check, definitely. So can you run through the reasons for that, Caroline?
Yes, we moved to that system a while back, and there are really good reasons. It's important that the needs of the baby and that check and the needs of the mother in the postnatal period can be considered separately, because actually that increases our chances of being able to address actually what might be very significant maternal concerns about big important topics like mental health, birth trauma, postnatal continence and gynecological issues. And to be able to do that at a time when hopefully the mum isn't having to prioritise the needs of the new baby and sort of, you know, do that juggle that we've all seen in our consulting rooms where they're trying to feed the baby or change them or stop them from crying and sort of holding it all together when actually they've some really big issues that they want to talk about.
Yes. And when you say it like that, it does make absolute sense. And you kind of think, why on earth haven't we done it all sooner? Now, I also really like the power of the two questions from the RCGP toolkit that we can use to start the really important conversations within the checks. And the questions are, has motherhood been what you expected? And then how was the birth? Beautifully simple, but really powerful ways to start to get to what we need to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just reflecting on a personal note, I really wish that I'd been asked those questions at my postnatal check. It's always really humbling, isn't it, to be on the other side of the doctor's desk and be a patient. And I can remember really wanting to talk about some big things, you know, a difficult fertility journey, hyperemesis, a traumatic birth, and the massive performance anxiety I was experiencing about being a new mum. And yet I found myself sat there answering questions at the end of the baby's appointment, you know, the how are things with you, and just saying, yeah, they're fine, great, really, just a bit tired. So even if the system you're working in doesn't enable you to separate out those appointments at the moment, I definitely encourage people who don't use those two questions already to give it a try and see what response you get.
Yeah, and I think it might be surprising about the responses that you do get, because it's a bit like when you ask somebody, are you okay? And they go, yeah. And then you go, are you okay? And then they almost like the facade drops and suddenly you get to see the real person. So well worth doing that. Another thing that I picked up from the article, and also from my work with the Red Whale Women's Health Team, is the importance of early advice and, if necessary, support and referral for continence and pelvic floor issues. And certainly the Women's Health Team are really, really passionate about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, NICE say that all females from the age of 12 should be made aware of pelvic floor health and encouraged to participate in pelvic floor exercises. And that we should ask about it at every pregnancy-related and postnatal consultation. Now, I don't know about you, Nick, but I'm definitely not discussing pelvic floor health with every 12-year-old I see. And I just think at the moment, the system pressures don't allow for that. But I think what I can commit to is asking about it at pregnancy and postnatal consultations. And the reason we should do that is because actually early support, if a woman is having problems, can make a really big impact on these really difficult and at times embarrassing symptoms. So what NICE says that we should refer women who've had instrumental deliveries or an OP presentation or anal sphincter injury, or any woman who in the postnatal period has stress or mixed incontinence, for supervised pelvic floor muscle training. And I bet lots of us aren't doing that at the moment.
Yeah. And I also can't help but think about the waiting list for this.
Well, absolutely. You know, we're working in system failure at the moment, and it's a very fair point. But the fact, you know, referring women who might need support is still something we should be doing. But if they have got a long wait, there's lots of information in our pelvic floor dysfunction article about resources women can use to get going with their own programs while they're waiting. So things like the Squeezy app and that sort of thing. And that might be worth a look if that's new to you. So, Nick, did anything surprise you on the baby side of the assessment?
Well, I thought it was a great reminder of how much we can achieve in a primary care consultation. NICE expects us to cover a lot, and I hope most practices now allow 20 minutes for this, and we get 20 minutes and I still sometimes run over. It's also reminded me that it's really important to have a clear top-to-toe system to cover all the things that we need to cover whilst dodging the inevitable wee when you remove the nappy. It's very important to be able to do that. And I'll be using this article with the trainees that I work with. But it's also important to be flexible because some bits need a calm and quiet baby. So don't use it as a rigid framework. You need to know what's in it and then you kind of tailor it. A bit like when you're working doing pediatrics, you're kind of told to do that kind of thing, aren't you? But I've got some top tips for trainees.
Yeah.
And they are, if the baby is happy and settled when they come in, make hay whilst the sun shines and listen to the heart and lungs first while they're on their parents' lap and they're nice and warm and quiet. And because if they become distressed, sometimes feeding them might also help and you can have a listen then. So that's two little tips there. Remove the nappy last is a tip and be ready to dodge or catch the wee from the front of the nappy. Anecdotally, this happens quite a lot with little boys and I can support that as well. So just be ready for that and also get somebody experienced to help you to practice the hip movements. And remember, these aren't easy. It's also important to know the risk factors for this as well, such as family history, a breech presentation, a high birth weight, which would be more than 5 kilograms, or congenital foot deformity. They're all important. And also minor risk factors would be oligohydramnios and prematurity. And if you aren't sure, then get somebody else to have a look with you. And then you can refer them for an ultrasound as well. And then my last tip, and try to do this to build your confidence as much as you can. And that is to see lots of normal babies and handle normal babies, because then you get to build that sixth sense of yours that you know that's a normal baby. And then when you might sense in the future, there's something not quite right about the baby that's with you. And so maybe because you need to get that kind of exposure, it's really worth asking your trainer how you can make that happen.
Yeah, they're all great tips, Nick. I think, you know, particularly for trainees who don't have the opportunity to do a paediatric job as part of their hospital post now, really essential. So if any of you as listeners have some good tips or stories that you'd like to share with our trainee colleagues, do send them in and we'll mention them on future pods.
Excellent. So our learning points for this Pearl are: allow ourselves enough time.
Consider seeing the mum and baby separately if you aren't already and the system will allow.
Use the two questions to open up conversations.
And have a systematic but flexible approach to examining wriggly babies and practice. And if you are a trainee or you have a trainee working at your practice who hasn't yet signed up for our Pearls and the special trainee Pearls we offer to help through the sort of exam years, please do sign up and tell your colleagues about it too. They're completely free and you can find the sign up information in the show notes.
Excellent. So that's the end of that Pearl. And now it's time for our final Pearl, saying no, assertiveness, winning friends and influencing people. And this one took me about 9 minutes, 46 seconds to read.
Now, this is the one that made me smile in a sort of slightly ironic way, because assertiveness and saying no has been a little bit of a personal career challenge for me. And I'm not totally sure I've won yet. And I think the introduction to this Pearl might well resonate with a lot of us. So if you're somewhere safe as you're listening to this podcast, just close your eyes for a minute and imagine these situations.
It's summer holiday season. You're demob happy. It's 18:35 in the evening. You're off for 2 weeks from tomorrow. You're just finishing up your final few blood results. Yes, really, you're there and about to put the out of office on your emails and washing up the 3 moldy tea mugs that have been lurking on your shelf for over a week. Just as you're about to shut down, an instant message pops up. Could you just squeeze in an extra / fit in an emergency coil / unblock the patient toilet / fix the vaccine fridge / track down gluten-free garlic naan? Delete as appropriate.
Or a different scenario. Perhaps you're taking your break after the school holidays. Your colleagues of school-age kids love you right now. And you have heroically volunteered to cover some extra urgent triage sessions while your other colleagues take a break. There you are, working through your email and your doc man, and the message pops up. The email comes into your box. Could you just do 2 extra sessions next week? Chase up bloods and scans for a patient seen in the left big toe clinic in secondary care last month. Magic up an urgent CAMS appointment. Delete as appropriate.
Now, of course, sometimes we may want to say yes to these things. And like never before, we also need to have each other's backs. But we might also need to say no, especially if it's a much needed break and that's just around the corner. And if we do need to say no, how good are we at being assertive? Not very, in my case.
That's a really good question, Nick. I'm sure everyone's listening out there thinking where they're at. So I've moved a long way from the days when back in around 2009, I was a newish full-time GP partner and I found myself sat on my own in the practice at about 8 o'clock at night, working through a list of patient callbacks that was three times as long as anybody else's. And one really was, where can I source gluten-free garlic naan bread? It isn't available on prescription. And worse still, the fact that I had created such poor boundaries that I could get that message in the first place, I'd actually started to Google an answer with a plan that I was going to get back to this patient. And it was just in that moment that I had sort of this awakening that I had a massive assertiveness and boundary issue. And I've been working on it since. So if I was writing my own school report now, I'd probably give myself a B-, could do better, but trying hard. What about you, Nick?
Well, I head in hands emoji. Please don't judge me at all. I just honestly a hopeless case here. There's so many examples. I'll give you one. So I was once working in a practice where the management team, one of the management team, they told me that because I was the only full-time GP, that they were thinking about only letting me have 1 week of leave maximum at a time, because having longer than a week impacted too much on the workload of the other clinicians. And in my head, I was thinking, I'm sorry, what? But I just went, yeah, that's fine. And just went away and thought about it and thought, but I was thinking, what, you know, what on earth is going through their minds? Cause I was so taken aback by that suggestion, but I just didn't like click in. What I should have gone was absolutely and utterly not. Next question. I did still get my proper annual leave, 2 weeks at a time stuff. So I did stand up for myself. But I think in the moment, I was just completely knocked sideways by the suggestion.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to hear you did get your leave. And I think that actually, it is sometimes that responding in the moment that's the most difficult thing. So I think the first thing to say is this pearl isn't going to solve all those problems. And, you know, if this is a topic that's immediately resonating with you, if like Nick and I, this is something you've struggled with or are struggling with, then think about setting a bit of your CPD time aside to sort of just digest and reflect on it. And as an aside, I'd really recommend Ed Pooley, who's a GP, has written an excellent book called Time Management in Primary Care. I've never met Ed, but I've read this recently and I think it's really grounded in practical real life examples. You can tell sort of someone who really does the job has written it. So Ed, if you're listening and you ever fancy writing us a guest blog on this that we can share, please do get in touch.
Yeah, I think I'll be reading it as well.
Yeah, I think it's a good read. So, Nick, why do you think that lots of us as clinicians find it so hard to say no?
Well, I think some of it's in our wiring. I think sometimes we have to say yes because there's an immediate serious clinical issue at stake. And I think that's where lots of this come from. And this can become a default mentality and we can end up running in this kind of hero mode, feeling like we have to save the world whilst gradually using up and destroying all of our kryptonite as well.
Yes, that's it, isn't it? And of course, you know, lots of us went into medicine or nursing or pharmacy or any clinical role really, because we like to help people. And I think if we're honest, sometimes we get some of our sense of achievement and self-worth from this. And many of us are also at the perfectionist end of the spectrum and our brains can sort of interpret saying no or not ticking everything off the to-do list, even if we didn't put it on there in the first place, as a failure and sort of not being good enough, when actually I think in this current climate we're working in, we need to see it for what it is. It's system failure, not personal failure. And keep saying yes to everything in a system which is failing is just a recipe for burnout.
Absolutely. And all of this has reminded me of our article on strengths and vulnerabilities of clinicians, which is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And have a read of that. And if you've got access to GPCPD, soon to be called Redwell Knowledge, then it's on there and you can access that and have a good read about it. And perhaps we'll run it as a pearl later on in the year.
That's a great idea, actually, Nick. So just like if anyone else is a bit confused by this, what actually is assertiveness? What are we aiming for?
Well, it encompasses three things which need great communication skills and well-developed emotional intelligence. And so to be assertive, we need to be able to, firstly, identify and express our emotions and feelings. Then we need to be able to state our opinions, thoughts and beliefs, even if it's difficult and they contradict others. And we also need to be able to stand up for ourselves and on occasion for others as well. And perhaps we're better at standing up for others than for ourselves. And we need to be able to do all of that without being abusive or aggressive. But this makes me wonder, is this something that we're just born with, or can we learn to be more assertive?
Well, actually, yes, we can. These are skills. And just in the same way we kind of learned how to break bad news or insert a catheter, we can learn them. But because they're new skills for some of us, we have to be a bit patient with ourselves. And remember, we're strengthening kind of new muscles, so it won't necessarily feel comfortable at first. And actually, Nick, I like what you said there. Sometimes the easiest place to practice this is for other people, because we often find it easier to be assertive for others than we do for ourselves, which is interesting, isn't it? So if this is something you find really difficult, we offer a simple model in the article that you might want to give a go, a way of structuring conversations where you need to have some kind of conflict and you want to be assertive. And we also offer some examples of how the conversations might go if you were in an assertive mode, an aggressive mode, or a passive mode. So there's loads of tips in there. And this was written from the perspective of saying no to kind of practice level requests. So the kind of thing Nick got asked, like, would you mind giving up all your annual leave? That sort of thing, rather than the kind of individual clinical requests we can get from patients. But we just wanted to pick out a few saying no tips that we liked that might be useful. So one of the things that can help, first of all, is getting in the right mindset. And a thing that really helps me is that just remember, everything that we say yes to, we're choosing to say no to something or someone else, including yourself or your family or your colleagues, or in fact, the other patients waiting for your time. It's never a kind of zero-sum game.
Yes. And so these are all great tips, and I'll be putting most of these on my action plan. So you need to ask yourself, am I the right person to be doing this task? And if you aren't, who should be? And why has this task ended up on your list? Is it a staff training issue? Do you need to train staff about this? And also, is it a patient training issue as well? Because we talk to our patients about things that they come to us with, so that it might be a conversation to have with them as well. You might want to reframe the scenario and say yes to the person, but no to the task. And how we do this will depend upon the scenario. And so what you can do, you can acknowledge where the person asking you to do something is coming from and empathize with them. And it might be a member of the reception team who's stressed out that a patient is stuck in the middle of the system failure that we're experiencing. So it might be to do with that. If it's a clinical issue that you can't deal with now, then signposting to a safe alternative may be your best available option, or better still, empowering the wider team to do that signposting.
Yeah.
If it's a want rather than a need, then you can use facts and evidence to back yourself up. For example, there is BMA guidance on passing inappropriate work from secondary to primary care. And there's also appointment data as well, which is about how many face-to-face appointments that you have available. So all of that kind of stuff can be helpful in those scenarios. If it's extra clinical sessions or a new meeting to attend, then you could try something like this. Thank you for thinking of me, and on other occasions I would be interested, but I'm working at full capacity at the moment, so on this occasion I can't do any extra clinics. And remember, you are only responsible for your response, not for other people's reactions to it.
Yeah, I think they're all really good tips, Nick, isn't it? And you know, often we want to keep everybody happy, but actually just acknowledging your own situation, using evidence, being fair, it's all really good stuff. And then this last one is one of my personal favourites. And this really worked for me when I was sort of early on in my journey. And the key message is buy yourself some time. So it's that moment, you know, you're like you, Nick, with your annual leave, you were sort of collared in the corridor and you find yourself saying, yes, that's fine, whilst internally screaming.
Yes.
Well, not everything needs an instant answer. And until you've strengthened your assertiveness muscles, you might find it easier just to create a pause between a request and saying no. So just saying something like, it sounds like an interesting opportunity, but I need to check my diary and consider whether I have capacity to give this the time it deserves. So I'll get back to you by email or face to face within a week. And that just gives you a bit of time to plan and, if necessary, to just script what you want to say and practice it with a colleague if that's what you need. So, yeah, some good tips.
Yeah, and you can't leave the country. You do have to get back to them. It's not a case of denying it. And
well, yes, you do.
In the sand. Now, on all of these things, we'd love to hear
run
your
for the hills.
Yeah, exactly, run for the hills. In all of these things, we'd love to hear your thoughts, your tips and your stories about trying to be more assertive in practice. So please do share them with us, and perhaps we can share them with our listeners as well, because as you've probably realised, we're all muddling through it together and we're all trying to get through at the moment. So anything we can do to support each other would be brilliant. So here are our learning points for the final pearl. Reflect on where you are with assertiveness. Is this something like us that you want to work on?
Remember that saying yes to one thing is always saying no to something else.
Can you say no if you need to? If not, what skills would you like to practice? And that's the end of all the pearls. So just before we go, we've got time for some primary care superheroes.
First superhero is from Nicola, and this is for Tamara, an admin at Beechwood Surgery in Brentwood. She's always cheerful and helpful to all staff and makes locums feel really welcome. She really does go out of her way to make sure everyone gets the nicest hot cup of coffee during busy surgeries.
Oh, and Lorraine would like to nominate Dr. Sid Chowler, an outstanding GP and all-round human being, puts others' needs first before his own. All-round top bloke. So thanks for that, Lorraine.
Oh. And another one from Nicola for Dr. Helen Pring, known for running late at times, but no one minds at all, as this is because she always gives patients as long as they need, is genuinely kind and compassionate GP. Oh.
Oh, so thank you for all of those. And you can send in your primary care superheroes nominations in the usual way. And there's a link in the show notes.
All the resources you need are in the show notes.
And all the links, as I was saying, are in the show description on your preferred podcasting platform.
We are at @GP_update on Twitter. If you want to see something about the podcast, then please use #RedWhalePod.
And the other thing that you can do if you click on the link in the bio is to leave us a voice message telling us about anything that you found helpful or you'd like us to go over.
And you can also email us. Our address is podcast@red-whale.co.uk. And I'm Caroline Green.
And I'm Nick Hendrew.
Until next time, remember to keep Redwell knowledge open on your desktop at work, so we're with you when you need some extra information or reassurance.
It's always open on my desk, so take care and look after yourself. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.